House Labor and Commerce will now come to orders, 3:15 on February 11th. We have a full committee. We have Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, myself, Chair Olson, Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, and last but not least, Representative Kito. Please turn your cell phones off. There is a slight penalty, either bagels or apples, depending on what the flavor is of the week for anybody whose cell phone goes off. Bagels. We have two bills on the agenda today, House Bill 81 and House Bill 9. We will start off with House Bill 81, exemption licensing of contractors. Presenting the bill, I believe, will be the sponsor and a committee aide.
Yes.
You want to do it from here or down there?
I'm going to move down there.
Okay.
Well, let's go with one second.
Representative Tilton, would you like to introduce your staff and then state your name and affiliation for the record as well?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is my aide, Dan. Let's see your last name.
That would be.
I always pronounce it wrong, so
welcome
I
welcome to the committee. I believe it's your first time before this committee. And
yes.
Sir.
The only one that bites is Conrad.
I'm just going to do a short introduction, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dan, if that would be all right with the chairman.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to present HB 81 relating to the licensing of residential contractors. For the record, my name is Representative Kathy Tilton, representing House District 12, including Chugiak, Wasilla, and the Butte. I introduced HB 81 after a discussion with members of the Mat-Su Home Builders. After speaking with contractors and realtors in other areas of the state and some affected home buyers, it became clear that there are some individuals that are exploiting an unintended loophole in the existing statutory language, thus creating an uneven playing field for licensed professionals who abide by the law and potentially exposing unwitting home buyers to substandard construction. In short, HB 81 is really a consumer protection bill and not a bill to restrict the trade. In order to better understand HB 81, it is important to understand what it is not, and what it does not do. HB 81 does not prevent Alaskans from building their own homes. HB 81 does not prevent Alaskans from ever selling a home they've built. And HB 81 does not propose a new licensure. It is not, nor was it ever meant, my intent to do any of those things. Now I'm going to breathe. Under current state law, the license contract exemption opens up a situation where an unlicensed contractor can operate a substantial business enterprise while avoiding licensure, bonding, and insurance requirements. I'm certain my fellow committee members remember the first home that they purchased and what a financial risk we felt in doing so. For most Alaskans, the purchase of their home is the largest investment they will ever make. HB 81 helps ensure that home buyers have expectations of a uniform standard of professionalism. HB 81 simply seeks to reasonably include all individuals engaged in home construction as a regular course of business in the existing residential contractor licensure. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dan Belrive. I'm staff for Representative Tilton. The issue that led to the creation of this bill was brought to the attention of Representative Tilton by home builders from the Mat-Su. A growing number of people are abusing exemptions in state law that were intended to allow people to act as their own general contractors. By abusing these exemptions, unlicensed contractors are able to operate substantial business enterprises without licensing, bonding, or insurance, creating an unfair playing field for contractors who do follow the law. HB 81 addresses this by establishing a time frame in which an owner-builder cannot sell a home after the completion of the home's instruction. Sorry, that's construction. This time frame is proposed at 2 years, but the bill provides the opportunity for the owner of the home to sell the home sooner if they notify the Department of Labor. Thank you.
Any questions?
I'll try one.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tilton, I like this bill, and so that's where this is coming from. But as I sit here now, in fact, would there be any constitutional problems with disposition of property, due process issues that might arise, in your opinion? in other words, you can't alienate or sell a home when you want to. Did Ledge Legal express any concerns?
Representative Justison through the chair. There was a few questions, but I think it's things that we've worked out, and I don't think that there should be a challenge with that.
Representative Ledoux.
Can I kind of respond to Representative Josephson's question?
Are you on the bill?
I'm going
to co-sign.
I mean, wouldn't that be the same if you were a contractor and you had bought a piece of property and you'd built a home? I mean, we have licensing requirements for all sorts of things, and you can sell those things, and you still have to get the appropriate licensing. And we don't say that somebody who owns a grocery store and wants to dispose or sell apples or oranges or something like that, that to make them have a business license or to be bonded or whatever you do for a grocery store would be a constitutional provision against alienation of property. Anyway, that's my thoughts.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux.
Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Tilton, isn't this an effort to get compliance with folks that are building homes and selling homes, perhaps without contractor licensing or paying workers' compensation or following the rules that generally most businesses in the home building industry do? Is that what this is about, kind of getting compliance on all the rules and regulations pertaining to employment, contractor licensing, and this is an effort to perhaps level the playing field with those that are operating outside of the regulatory environment?
Representative Culver, through the chair, I think you could look at it that way. It's not to stop people from building their own homes and selling their own homes. It's to look for patterns of people that do it consistently. There was a loophole in the legislation, the statute that sits on the books right now, and it's to stop that loophole and make an even playing field.
Thank you.
Paul?
Well, it's a different question, Mr. Chair, but I'm just on page 2, section 11, when we get into discussion of the, it says the exemption in this paragraph does not apply if the structure under construction is advertised for sale or sold during the period of construction or for a period of 2 years after the period of construction ends, unless the owner can demonstrate to the department's satisfaction the sale would not result in circumvention of the requirements under this chapter. So that's if a person was an owner builder and within that 2 year period there's a necessity to sell the home, what does department's satisfaction, my only concern is what does that mean? What hurdle do you have to jump over? Is it divorce? Is it loss of job? Is it okay to simply pass title, not a sale, to, let's just say, you add your spouse on the deed or something like that? I was just looking for some clarity on what that parameter and how we got that language, I guess. Thank you.
Representative Culver, through the chair, I'm going to defer this to my Dan.
Representative Culver, through the chair, if I may defer this to Ms. Sarah Chambers, who's the Director of the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing.
I see Sarah sitting in the front row. Please join us, Sarah.
Commerce, okay.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Acting Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And to the department's satisfaction, through the chair, would be a process that we would determine through the public comment process and regulations. That would be an open and transparent process that would be available for public scrutiny, but codified in regulations to ensure that that process is not a mystery to anyone who may wish to apply for it.
I might add, we have two lifelines on the off-net, Al Nagel and Gray Mitchell as well, if the sponsor, Sarah, feels appropriate. We can have them weigh in as well. Representative Ledoux.
So you're going to put in regulation exactly what the parameters would be of, with respect to what kind of things you would accept as not trying to circumvent the law?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's correct.
Follow up?
Oh.
And would there be a catch-all for, and any other circumstance in which the department felt that it wouldn't circumvent the law?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we would want to create a process that was, again, transparent and educational to the public without being so restrictive that we would find if there may be some other qualifying circumstances that wouldn't fit within that structure. The nature of setting a standard for the public to conform to per administrative code has to be in regulation, but again, we would want to be able to make that a process that would meet that intent and close that loophole and not be unduly restrictive.
So, follow up. So, is the answer to that yes?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Acting Director, could you perhaps provide the committee something that, what your thoughts are, or the department's thoughts are, on what those conditions might be that would be in those proposed regulations? I'm looking for what that looks like, that this language, because we don't have it identified, it doesn't tell me a lot. And the second question, if that's appropriate, if we don't move this bill, would you be so kind as to provide that to the committee, some kind of idea of what that framework looks like in writing and situations that would fall under this category? What has been done by the department to enforce contracting regulations and also the requirement that general contractors building homes have a residential endorsement? And I think that was part of the last rewrites, was requiring a residential endorsement. If you're going to build homes, you have to go through training and get certified before you can be. What have you tried to assist the industry in the Met Valley to get compliance? Can you kind of describe the enforcement actions, what's been done, why we need this? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Colbert, I'd be happy to. We have a relationship with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. As the chair mentioned, Director Mitchell and Mr. Nagel are online, and they are our primary contacts in our relationship to enforce construction contractor licensing throughout the state. We have it is our department, the Department of Commerce's title in which these enforcement statutes lie, but the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division sends out inspectors throughout the state already to do wage and hour inspections and ensure compliance. So as an efficiency measure, we thought that years ago that it would make sense for them to also do licensing compliance at the same time. So instead of having two forces out across the state seeking compliance, there's one very skilled and educated force that's doing that for themselves and on our behalf. So they are issuing fines, cease and desist letters, and then we follow up with the fine collection. Ultimately, our goal is to provide compliance, as you mentioned. There are opportunities for people to be unaware of the law. There are opportunities for people to be first-time offenders, and we have the ability to lessen finding circumstances if they come into compliance. And ultimately, though, if we have repeat offenders or we have people who are blatantly skirting the law, we have the ability to take a stronger hand in that regard.
Thank you. I just follow up, Mr. Chair. Is there data available, like scrub, that doesn't have names on it that we could see visually? This was reported, this was investigated, so that we could kind of see the history for back up the legislative intent here of what the issue is of noncompliance with the general contracting. You administer the licensing and issue the licenses, and as I understand, Department of Labor does the building and wage and hour inspections to verify if those folks are properly licensed and have the right credentials.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, we have on our website, and I'd be happy to provide to the committee as well, an overview of all of the contractor enforcement activities that occurred, as well as with names, those who were found to be out of compliance and ultimately license action or unlicensed action was taking place. I'd be happy to look through and see what data we could quickly provide to the committee regarding this particular issue and get to you whatever we can in a timely manner.
That would be most helpful. Thank you.
And I might add at this point in time that we will not be moving the bill out today, so there'll be adequate time. I guess that brings us to the fiscal note. Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you mentioned that this was brought to your attention, bill sponsor, in the MATSU, but is it occurring, was it a problem other places in the state?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, yes, it is a challenge that has occurred throughout the state. It is a number one priority of the Alaska State Home Builders on their list of priorities, legislative priorities this session. And so I was first approached by the MATSU Home Builders, but then approached by the state home builders as well.
Thank you.
I might add, my home builders were in town this week, and it's a priority for them as well. Mm-hmm. So it is on the Kenai Peninsula, too. Anchorage, I think they have a lot of building inspectors. It's probably not quite as prevalent, but in the smaller communities, it is. What does that have to do?
So are we going to be discussing the fiscal note right now, or?
In a minute, yeah. Any further questions before we get to the fiscal note? Who wants to take it on?
No,
the guy in the middle?
Chairman Olson, there and the committee members, there is a small fiscal note of $2,500 that came from the department, and we are working with them to see what we can do to zero that out.
I believe we didn't have that last year, did we?
It was not on there last year.
But that's one of the reasons we're not moving the bill out today for the people in the room. We're going to see if there's leeway on the fiscal note, since it's representing the bill.
So I just want to make sure that I read this right. It's $2,500, not like, I mean, most fiscal notes around here, you see 2.5 and it means 2.5 million or something. So we're actually talking about just $2,500?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, yes, we're talking about $2,500, to which I had the same reaction. Considering that the contractors do pay fees and it does end up paying for itself, but there are some items that we are working with the department to see if we can work through that.
Thank you.
Pass a hat around. We could pass her a hat around.
Right.
We can't make any budget jokes in this committee until later in the year. Any further questions before we open it up to public testimony? Representative Liddell? Nope. With that, we will now open up public testimony. I'm going to start in the room, and I believe we have Alan Wilson with us. Welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Alan Wilson. I am a longtime chairperson for the Alaska State Home Builders Legislative Committee, and have been before you on this topic before. Obviously, this is a Home Builder Association's number one piece of legislation for the year at this point in time. The problems are magnified, I think, in the valley. As you stated earlier, the Kenai Peninsula has been having some problems, and then rural Alaska is having some issues as well on this topic. We see this as more of a consumer protection bill, as well as closing this technicality loophole, in that when homeowners are calling our associations and saying, you know, holding us responsible, we somewhat feel it's time to take some action. I'm not going to make any bones about the fact that there is a fact of leveling the playing field here with people that are operating outside of the regulations that all of us abide by. But I think the bigger issue really is consumer protection, as well as cleaning up the regs so that these laws can be enforced. We have worked extensively with the Department of Labor, Greg Mitchell and his guys in enforcement, and we've made a lot of progress with enforcement actions and in the citations now that are available. We're doing really well. The department's doing well in helping us with these issues, but this has become to the point where it's risen to the top of the pile. And hopefully you will support us in this action and move forward. I would like to just comment on the fiscal note as well. It was somewhat of a surprise to myself, since we didn't have one last year. And I was talking to the director earlier about how can there be a fiscal note in a department that is basically funded by my license fees. And, you know, she explained that to me, and since I'm not that legislative writing or regulation writer type person, it's all Greek. But I do, you know, we are willing to pay extra fees if we're getting something for that. And with that, I will answer any questions if need be.
Anybody got any questions for Mr. Wilson? Representative Hudo.
Thank you, and welcome, Alan. Good to see you here. I just wanted the clarification that when you mentioned the valley, you were talking about the Matanuskas who sit in the valley.
Representative Hudo, future, that is correct. I was referring to the Mat Valley. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, ma'am.
And is there anybody online? Andres Spinelli, I believe, is online in Anchorage.
Hello?
Well, thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
My name is Andres Spinelli. I'm with Spinell Home. I'm a home builder in Anchorage, Alaska. We build from Girdwood to the Matsu Valley. And I'd like to testify in support of the bill, and I'd just like to let everybody know that this is not just a rural problem or a Matsu problem. It happens everywhere. It just might not be quite as obvious. I see it happen in Anchorage, which is a heavily regulated building environment. And guys will build a house without a license and have a for sale sign out in front of the house the entire time. So essentially competing with me without, you know, carrying the proper licensing or paying the appropriate fees. One other item I'd like to add is that, sorry, kind of had some technical difficulties here. Another item I'd like to add is that in the bill, really, the way this all started is we were talking with the state and trying to get them to crack down on these guys who were doing this. They couldn't. They tried to write some tickets, and they eventually got to the Attorney General that said the law that's in existence is too vague for us to enforce. And so all we're really trying to do is tighten up the existing law. And then one other thing is that when an owner-builder builds a house, because this is Alaska and there's people all over and they maybe can't get a residential endorsed contractor or a licensed plumber or electrician, they're allowed to do their own, perform their own plumbing and electrical. And I've talked to plumbing contractors that have worked for a guy on one house, and he followed them around and asked them questions about the work they were doing. And then on the next house, he saw that guy building. These guys sell these houses, competing with licensed contractors. And then on the next house, that guy was apparently not hiring a contractor, a plumbing contractor. So I think that they're, you know, circumventing, you know, even more laws by being an owner-builder. They can put in their own electrical and plumbing, and it really does become a consumer protection issue. That's all I have.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Any questions for Mr. Spinelli? Seeing none, thanks again. Robert Yen from Matsu Home Builders, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Robert Yen. I am a resident of the Matsu Valley here and the vice president for the Matsu Valley Home Builders Association.
Please continue.
Not to duplicate what Andre said, but just to give you some background here, I was born and raised out here. My family's been here since the 40s, and I was an owner-builder. I graduated Wausaukee High in 98. It took me 4 years of going back and forth from the slope to make the money to build my first home. I still consult and help people that are doing it. I have family members. This is not, our objective here is not to harm anybody who wants to put sweat equity into a project by any means. We deal with day in and day out, as does the state inspectors, Michael Page and these guys, who really work hard. We deal with a lot of people out here in the Matsu Valley. I can't speak for the peninsula or anywhere else, but that are building multiple homes at a time, sometimes in the same subdivision, and have real estate signs out front the entire time. As well as marketing on Craigslist and different things, you know. And I got a call a few years ago from another builder out here asking me if I built a home on Kirsten Drive. This is many years ago. I said, yeah, I'd done most of them, all but one. He says, well, a family died there last night. There was, I think, one or two survivors of the kids, but maybe both parents died. I can't remember exactly. And I was like, well, I can assure you it wasn't the one I built. I know there was a family there that was doing an owner build, and they had hired a general to come in and help them on the side as a consultant. Really nice young couple, had a few kids. I went over, gave them a ton of advice during the concrete and dirt work stage, but then I was off the road and out of there and never seen them again. And what happened was they played with some of the mechanical appliances in their house after they got finished with it. And because there was no air exchange whatsoever in the home, basically going back to a contractor with no continuing education, there was deaths in there when there shouldn't have been. And carbon monoxide backdrafting into the home, the things that would never have happened in a home built by somebody who has to maintain continuing education. It just wouldn't happen. And so it is hard for us as builders and businessmen and women to stomach people who aren't playing by the rules when we try so hard to do it. But even looking past us, it's also very much about consumer protection. And I do support HB 81. I think it's a big step in the right direction to hopefully at least encourage them. If you want to know the truth, I don't think any of the people who are doing what they're doing out here in the Valley are going to stop building. I think what they're going to do is finally go and get licensed, get a residential endorsement, and have to take the continuing education classes that myself and all the members, other builders out there do. And I think that's going to be a huge step in the right direction for us and for our residents. if you guys got any questions, I would love to answer them.
We have at least one representative to do.
Andre, how is this going to be policed? Do you anticipate that, for example, the banks are going to be requiring some sort of certificate that
you know,
it's okay? Pardon me?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but unfortunately, ma'am, these people don't use Alaska Housing Finance when they get loans. So these builders are having their clients go to larger organizations such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and just nationwide, Fannie Mae doesn't require, conventional financing doesn't require inspections, really. They require a life and safety inspection at the end, but not a full set of PUR inspections like we do here in Alaska. So there are ways around it, finance-wise. You know, by this closing up the loophole on allowing them to market and to sell, it's gonna force them to get a residential endorsement and to take continuing education classes.
Just follow up here. So how are they going to be, if somebody is out there and they sold a home, so, and it's within the 2-year period, how are you going to know before he sold the home that he's selling the home? And then what sort of teeth are there if he sells the home? Is the purchaser going to be able to, if there are any problems with it, is he going to be able to declare it null and void? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how to put teeth into this thing other than saying that they can't do it. And I mean, the people that we're saying you can't do it to have already seemed to not care if there's some reason that they can't do it. How are you going to stop them?
Well, my understanding is, because a couple of these cases have reached the Attorney General, that by them not having the ability to openly market in these things, it's going to give them the teeth they need. Is it going to happen? I do believe it is, but I will tell you from a business standpoint, because we all are out there getting construction loans, even the people breaking the rules, just like the people that aren't. If it takes you, say, 4 to 6 months to build a house, and that's pretty standard in the Mattsu Valley, depending on the time of the year you start, but if you're not marketing, because other generals are going to police this, I can guarantee you that, you know, the fiscal expense to the state, the $2,500, I'm not sure where that comes from, because I know they have, they have boots on the ground already, and it'll be the same boots that we'll be handling this, but it'll be the job of us generals to police and to monitor. And if we know a guy, because there are guys out here that do numerous homes a year that don't have any of these licensing, if they have a for sale sign, then obviously I'm going to call Michael Page from the state or whoever it may be and bring them out. And, you know, so that's, if they have a construction loan or a private lender, many of these people have private lenders, they have terms on their loans, I guess, to answer your question. And there's no way they're going to be able to keep their lender happy if they can't get the project sold in a timely manner. So, again, I don't actually think this is going to stop any of them from building. And part of me hopes that it really doesn't, to tell you the truth. I think it's going to force them to follow the rules and to get the proper licensing. And so they can have that realtor sign out there the entire time, and they can sell the project and make their lender happy. So I don't know if that was a very good answer to your question. I apologize if it's
no,
not.
No, actually it was a good answer.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again for joining us today. Is there anybody else on online at the LIOs? Seeing none, is there anybody in the room who would care to testify on behalf of or against House Bill 81? Please join us.
Hello, my name is Kirk Perisic. I'm with the Carpenters Union, 1281. I see regulation for the homeowners as being a good thing. It's one of the things that's probably needed. One of the things that I noticed as far as the exemptions for 10 on the owner-tenant and commercial property who uses an owner-tenant's employees to maintain, repair, or alter the work on that upon that property. I'm curious as far as is that leaving a loophole for commercial to be done by owners? Is there going to be a certain price that they can stop at for altering or actually repairing or maintaining their commercial properties? And kind of why would there be a loophole for commercial and not for residential?
I certainly don't have an answer, but I would suggest that you contact the sponsor's office, and she can walk you through what was done. Typically, we don't have question and answers going back, but I tend to agree with you. It makes sense. But.
Yeah, to me, it just almost seems like it might leave a loophole for people that are in the commercial industry to start. I mean, some owners are owning hundreds of millions of dollars worth of property, and their repairs are going to be in the tens of millions, yeah, or alterations. And to be able to just, you know, have somebody that they're paying $7.50 an hour or something to start doing alterations and repairs on their building would seem kind of...
Representative, what's your room number?
We're in room 411, and you're welcome to come up, and we can talk about this after the hearing.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Can we take a question from Representative Liddell?
Of course.
Yeah, I guess I would just like to point out that with respect to 10, that looks like that exemption is in the old law, and that the only thing that this bill has done is kind of a editorial change. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's still a good question that you have, but it really doesn't change things.
Right.
Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the concern, I think with this is existing law, I think the intent of it is you can do maintenance, minor alterations. It doesn't get into major maintenance. Can usually consider something different, construction, and then you need a contractor's license. But just, you know, maybe move a wall or fix a toilet or what have you for a commercial owner. It basically says we don't need a contractor's license for that, but if you're going to do, of course, you do anything that's commercial electric, you're going to need to be approved by an electrical administrator. You know, the standards are much higher, of course, for electrical, plumbing in a commercial building, and then those set of laws which aren't here in the plumbing and electrical codes are going to apply. I think this is more referencing to minimal, minor maintenance,
right,
on an owned building rather than what we would call expensive project. Major maintenance, which would, you know, involve a lot of components.
Kind of why I brought up the fact that it would be nice to have maybe a dollar amount of,
yeah,
minor alterations on commercial properties.
Thanks again for joining us today. Great Metro, you still with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
This is Colonel Wilson. Do you have any thoughts on what we were just talking about?
I could add a few things to the mix. This is Gray Mitchell. I'm the director of the Division of Labor Standards and Safety. There was a question about, you know, our enforcement activity, and I had Al Nagel, who's also on the phone, run some numbers just to kind of give the committee an idea of, you know, what kinds of problems we've come across in this area. And since FY 2011, we've had 30 administrative fines issued for owner-builder violations. Our high year was in FY 2011, where we had 16 in 1 year. And these were all violations associated with a person who was building more than one structure within that two-year period, you know, and so that's really what I think the bill is trying to tighten up on, is just to make it a little bit more clear when you come across a house that's got a for sale sign up on it, or a house that's recently been completed and it's you know, it's being sold, and a contractor who's maybe working in the same subdivision says, hey, that's, you know, that's not somebody just building their own house. that we would look into those scenarios and be able to have a little bit of a cleaner way to show that, you know, there is a violation. You know, so that's pretty straightforward. One of the things that that the department had, you know, a suggestion on was that perhaps paragraph 10, current paragraph 10, in this version on page 2, it's at line 10, and it's proposed to be paragraph 9 under the bill. But you see the language there says that a person who works on that person's own property, whether occupied by the person or not, and a person working on that person's own residence, whether owned by the person or not, is also an exemption from contractor licensing. We've had a few situations, and I think that this is one of the issues that some of the other people who testified were referring to when they had indicated that the Attorney General had looked at some of the violations that we had identified and found that there was some vagueness to the law that precluded our enforcement. And this paragraph, what we had interpreted that to mean was that it would apply to a person who's working on their own property on an existing structure rather than ground-up construction, a brand-new building. Apparently that is not clear in the legislative intent, and right now there's not a regulation that further defines it either. So one of the potential solutions would be to add the word existing structures to that paragraph, just to clear it up so that we didn't have this ongoing confusion about owner builders, you know, building a house from ground up versus owner builders who are working on their existing house.
Representative Colbert.
Mr. Mitchell, thank you for the clarity on that issue. So, that provision made the two-year restriction unenforceable as interpreted by the Attorney General, is what I think I'm hearing you saying. So, if we tightened up that section, add your suggested language, existing structures, would we have an enforceable statute with the prohibition of a two-year waiting period for an owner-builder without adding the department's review and consideration of the factors that led to the sale or involving more government? Could we simply tighten up that clause and achieve compliance with the existing statute?
Well, clearly I would say that clarifying the paragraph that I referenced there, which is currently paragraph number 10, proposed to be paragraph 9, would be a big help in resolving you know, this sort of loophole that exists for owner builders. At the same time, you know, I've heard the people who testified earlier talking about the problems associated with an owner builder, you know, putting a for sale sign up on a house while they're building it or immediately after they finish it, and currently there's not really a clean way to say, you know, that's you're competing with licensed contractors in that scenario. And so, you know, I suppose there's a need for both.
Okay.
Follow up?
Well, clearly it's, do you have, well, it's not a follow up on that one, but we had testimony about the carbon monoxide in the heating system in a home in Wasilla. Were you aware of the facts of that tragedy? I understand it was the homeowner that changed something themselves on the home air intake or something like that. Do you know that? I'd sure like to get the facts on that because it was very tragic, but what really happened?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, I don't know the exact details on that. It wouldn't typically be something that we would investigate as an owner-builder making changes to their property is exempt from contractor licensing. It is something that can happen, and it is a tragedy when the work isn't done correctly. But you know, that is kind of a sacred area for people to be able to work on their own houses. You know, we can only hope that they do the work properly and get the right guidance when they do that work or try to take it on themselves. But right now, you know, we don't have a way to police that at all.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure it's really related to the owner-builder, but I'll try to get the backup. I know the people that fix the system, so I'm trying to find out the facts on that. Did you write the language that's proposed to the department's satisfaction? In other words, what the waivers are for selling a home within 2 years? Does that come out of Department of Labor, wage and hour, or compliance enforcement?
No. Through the chair, Representative Culver, that, you know, when you asked the question earlier about how, you know, those standards would be established or what, you know, the department would use, and I heard Director Chambers talk to that issue and, you know, suggest that regulations might be the way to address it. I was kind of thinking more of a, you know, just kind of a common sense approach where, you know, we would look at whether or not there was any evidence to demonstrate that the person was actually acting as a contractor, you know, a history of past violations of contractor licensing requirements, a history of, you know, acting as an owner-builder on projects. You know, we'd look into all these things and then, of course, if a person could provide a good reason why they were needing to sell the house, and this would really only happen, I think, where they would need to demonstrate something to the department if we were pursuing an enforcement action, and then they would bring forward, you know, say, hey, you know, I don't think that you should pursue an administrative fine against me or some other enforcement action because, you know, I'm selling my house because I've got a, you know, medical situation or, you know, there's a family emergency or I lost my job or, you know, I got a divorce or whatever it is. And we just look at that and say, well, does that make sense or not? And if it does, then, you know, we'd accept it. And if it didn't, then we'd say, nah, we're not going to accept that. But that was under the enforcement provisions, the person who receives an administrative penalty still has the ability to request a hearing before a third party. And they could make their case there, too, and say, hey, I don't think this should apply because I'm an owner-builder and, you know, this is the only time I've ever built my own house and, you know, the department's way off base here. And then, you would hope that a third party would say, well, geez, you know, that doesn't sound right. Or, you know, if the department came forward with a bunch of cases showing here's, you know, this is the fourth house this person has built in the last 3 years, that they would say, boom, you know, that's the kind of person that we're trying to stop from operating under this owner-builder exemption.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks again. Is there anybody else in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Hearing none, is there anybody online? Hearing none again, we will close out public testimony and hold this bill over until we get the fiscal note issue resolved, and we'll take a brief of these. We're back on the record. The second item on the calendar today is House Bill 9, Private Investigators/Agencies. This bill sounds familiar, too. I believe we heard this one last year. Find where I'm at. This bill is sponsored by Representative Hughes, who is, do you want to carry it from here or down there?
Yeah.
And is Ginger going to help you?
Yes.
Bring her up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Shelley Hughes, representative from Palmer, and with me is Ginger Blaisdell, my chief of staff, who will probably speak to the bill a little bit more, but I want to just introduce
to introduce it. We did indeed, Mr. Chair, have this bill before us last year. We brought it forward because it was brought to my attention that a felon in our state could get a business license as a private investigator. And I didn't think that was good. And I actually had heard about a situation where a family who'd lost a daughter had been approached by such an individual. And there is a presumption of authority by the public when someone comes and says they're a private investigator, and there can be a tendency for the person, a citizen, to be willing to participate and offer information, personal information, that they might not otherwise to someone else because of the title that that person bears as private investigator. So I believe that it was something that we should address, and we did it in such a way, as Ginger will talk to you, not to establish a costly review board, as you know, we learned about the 43 professions that we have in our state, that the division overviews, and so it's patterned after some other professions where it's a matter of some forms, and the persons acquiring the license would pay the fees to cover those forms. I will say we do have some questions about the fiscal note, as it, I believe, it quadrupled from last year. So we do have questions about that. But I'm going to let Ginger, if I may, Mr. Chair, talk to you about some of the particulars of the requirements of what the person applying for the license, the steps and requirements.
Welcome back, Ginger. Please bring yourself onto the record.
Thank you. My name is Ginger Blaisdell. I'm staff to Representative Hughes. And would you like me to just go through section by section and talk about what we're offering? Okay. Section 1 just adds a new professional license group to the other professional license groups under the Department of Commerce. And then Section 2 starts to talk about that a private investigator must be licensed. And it clearly states that you may not practice private investigating unless you're licensed under this or unless you're exempt. And there's a fairly large exemption list further in the bill. You may not use the title of a private investigator unless you're, again, registered with the department. And you may not practice as a private investigator unless you're registered with the department, or it can result in a misdemeanor. On page 2, it starts with the scope of practice, and it talks about the kind of job tasks that you might do as a private investigator. And so it could be investigating criminal offenses, it could be obtaining information from individuals. A lot of it is evidence to be used in court. And that's also part of the problem that we found as private investors came to us. If someone has not been trained to be a private investigator, sometimes the collection of that evidence is found to be inappropriately collected, or there might be some kind of a mistake. And so sometimes it's not allowed in court, and that becomes very costly. It can become very time consuming, and you might end up with an outcome of a court case that maybe you didn't expect. The next section on the bottom of page 2 is general requirements for investigators. So in order to get a license, you need to be a citizen. You cannot be convicted of a felony in the 10 years preceding. You can't have crimes of moral turpitude or sexual misconduct. There are a few crimes that are specifically egregious. And you can't be on probation or parole. You cannot have been dishonorably discharged from the armed forces. And may not be declared by a court of to be mentally incompetent. So there's a few things describing the type of person that you need to be in order to be a private investigator. Classes of licenses. We created two classes, a Class A license. Oh, I have some feedback here, sorry. The Class A license is a more advanced license. It's someone who has had very specific training. They may actually own an agency, may have people working for them. A Class B license would be more likely to be an apprentice, someone who's trying to acquire the hours to be qualified to be a Class A license holder, and or someone who just needs to get a little bit more training. On the bottom of page 4, it talks about the license application. So full name, business name, residence, those kinds of things that are pretty standard. A few things that make it a little bit different are criminal history and conviction record. So we do want them to identify if they have a criminal history. Look at their employment records. That's fairly standard. A statement that you are free from mental illness. And then to have that document then notarized. The other requirement that we have on the bottom of page 5 is fingerprints. The fees associated with that would be borne by the person applying for the professional licensure. At the top of page 6, you'll see that we also are asking for letters of recommendations from 3 citizens with no prior felony convictions. And that's more of a character reference. That's the majority of everything. You sign it saying that, yes, this is all true. Investigation of applicants that allows the department to go in and actually investigate the background of a licensee. So they may not have to be a private eye and have that license. They can go in and look. There is a reciprocity section. So if you are a private investigator from another state and you are licensed in that other state, with the generally the same kinds of expectations we have for Alaska licensure, that would be allowed in the state of Alaska.
How many states would that be approximately?
I don't know how many states. I know that last year when we ran some data from the department, there were about 109 Alaska residences of folks that had signed up as a private investigator, and there were about 40 from out of state. We've spoken with 2 private investigators from out of state.
One was how many states provide reciprocity? How many would we be looking at that would where we would have reciprocity?
This provision allows Alaska to recognize those states' licensure. I don't know how many states would recognize Alaska's, so it might be a one-way reciprocity. There are
how many would meet our qualifications is what I'm trying to get at.
And that I can't answer specifically because the research I did shows there's only 4 states in the United States that do not have licensure requirements for private investigators. Some of those states, it's in a municipal setting. Some of them are statewide law. So there was such a variety, I can't tell you exactly how many states. A license card, so the department would actually issue some type of an identification card that would have your private investigator license number on it. And then ask that the private investigator carry that card, so if someone were to ask for ID, they could show it. An agency certificate is going to be a Type A licensee, and they might have people working for them, so that. And that also would require a surety bond and insurance for those folks working for them. License renewal, non-transferability, you can't change the name and give it to somebody else and have them be your private investigator. And it does talk about paying a renewal fee, and after 5 years you would go through a background check. So every 5 years or about every 3rd renewal you would do a new background check. At the top of page 9 is a section that is called firearms training. And Last year when we started with this bill, we did not have a firearms provision in there. The committee at that time requested that we put some in to make sure that people that are entering into a potentially high-risk situation would have some sort of training on the use of firearms. And so the section is back in, asking them basically to complete a successful firearms training. Confidentiality of the licensee's information, so that it's confidential. Prohibited practices is talking about making sure you're not collecting information for illegal purposes. So if you present yourself as a private investigator and then you suddenly some of that information shows up on the web or it's sold to some kind of a distributor or photographs are used inappropriately, those kinds of things are considered a violation. You can't wear a uniform or carry a badge showing that you're a private investigator. You can actually go out to eBay and purchase a very legitimate-looking private investigator badge for $14.95. It looks pretty good. You can't have flashing vehicle lights. So basically, you can't portray yourself as having some kind of official status without being an actual private investigator. Immunity for complainants basically says that someone can make a complaint against you if the complaint is done in good faith. When you're a private investigator, there's probably some people that you might run across who don't want to give up any information, whether it might be receiving a court warrant or a subpoena. So they might complain and say, hey, they caught me at Tasty Freeze, you know. So you can't be sued for damages because you found the person you're trying to find when they were not suspecting it. Administrative Procedures Act basically says that the regulations are going to be conducted by administrative procedures by the department, so they follow a set of rules. And in the very bottom of page 10, but primarily on page 11 and most of 12, are all of the types of people who are exempt from being a private investigator. These are people who typically do personal investigative services in their normal course of business, like an attorney, like a law enforcement officer, insurance agents, employees of banks who have to do some research, forensic scientists. We do have the fire investigators. Most of them are firefighters or volunteer firefighters, but fire investigators are exempt. Pre-employment check folks are exempt from this. Paralegals. So there's a number of professions that are exempt from having to be licensed as a private investigator. And then we have a short set of definitions, and transitional provisions allow that someone who has met the requirements of this chapter and they're already operating as a private investigator can continue operating until they renew their business license, and then at that point they will go through the review and the background check. The effective date on this bill is July 2015, and speaking with the department, I think they would like to postpone that if it were to pass so that they would have time to get regulations in place and get it on a regular schedule that they could manage. So.
Mr. Chair, Ginger, thank you very much. You did a good job, and sometimes nerves make us say something. So I just want to correct something, because at one point she used the word without instead of while, and it was when she was referring to you can't wear a badge while being a private investigator is the correct. And it's not just referring to a $14 private investigator badge, but portraying any kind of badge, being an official, trying to portray oneself as a law enforcement or some state or federal official. So can't do that while you're a private investigator. And she accidentally used the word without being one, so it sounded like we were giving them permission to do that. So I just want to make sure we corrected that on the record.
How about walking us through the fiscal note? You might want Sarah up, I'm guessing.
Yes, Chairman Olson. I think what I'd like to do is request that Sarah Chambers come up and discuss the fiscal note. And I think in your packet, I think there is included the fiscal note from the prior year. So you might see one that at the top right-hand corner says HB 253. That was from the prior session. This one for HB 9 is a very different looking fiscal note. And I think she can describe what those differences are. Some of them actually don't pertain to private investigating, so I hope that she will venture into that conversation.
Representative Liddell.
Before we go into the fiscal note, I'm wondering if I could ask Ms. Blaisdell or Representative Hughes one question. Mm-hmm. So on page 3, line 13 and 14, section C, that provision seems overly vague to me. It seems to give the department pretty unfettered authority to say yay or nay for conflict of interest as opposed to specifying things. Tell me why I shouldn't be uncomfortable with that.
Ginger, do you know the origin of that? I don't.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. What we did, we patterned this particular law after the state of Colorado's, and then we reduced a lot of their requirements because they were very, very stringent. So as I read this section, it is to obtain a license, the private investigator or the applicant may not be currently employed in a position the department determines to represent a conflict of interest for the prospective licensee. And so we specifically identify a peace officer, and we specifically identify someone in the United States, state, or local government if the position is a law enforcement. Oh, sorry, I pushed it back because it was echoing. So if you basically look as though you're a law enforcement individual, there might be a profession that you are employed in that when you become a private investigator, it could create a conflict of interest, such as if I were a human resource officer and filed to be a private investigator, I was able to obtain maybe more information that maybe a human resource information officer shouldn't have. There's always going to be that odd circumstance, and whether or not we want to give carte blanche authority to the department to determine those or not is certainly.
I just feel uncomfortable with that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, I would invite you if you have a suggestion for that. We would certainly be open to entertaining it if there's a way to make that better.
Perhaps we could give the Judicial Committee referral as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Could I do likewise and ask just a couple questions of the?
Certainly.
Thank you. Through the chair for, I guess, Ms. Blaisdell. It's very comprehensive. my first question would be about the top of page 2, scope of practice. I would be, when I read this, I thought, well, this covers a lot, but how do we know this covers all the activities of a private investigator? It seems to, but what did you use to sort of for the coverage here, the activities that a private investigator conducts? Is that from a model bill or?
Again, this one started, through the chair, Representative Joseph, this one started with Colorado's legislation. Okay. And a little bit of it was tweaked according to legislative legal's recommendations to make sure that it kind of followed other statutes and make sure we weren't overreaching some places.
Okay.
So, you know, like for the purpose of obtaining information about who's responsible for fires, losses, accidents, damage to persons. Some of those she just wanted us to include. It's a combination, truly. But most of it came from the Colorado law that we were originally looking at.
Okay, just a couple more.
Mr. Chair, I might want to add to that, too, because this we did have this out in prior legislature, in front of a prior legislature. We have had input and review by a number of private investigators. I don't know if anybody's weighed in on that particular line, but we've certainly had an open door to that. So if there's something missing, I think they would have told us.
Okay. Then on page 7 at the bottom, the errors and omissions. What do we know? The question is, what do we know about private investigator negligence? In other words, the way I read that is that they could be liable for errors. And so my first question is there a market? Can a private investigator actually purchase insurance? If there is, that sort of answers my question, that there must be some potential liability. But I've never heard of any. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I just didn't know if someone knew anything about a private investigator being sued for saying that there was adultery going on when there wasn't. I don't know. That sort of thing.
Is there? Mm-hmm. Okay. Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So errors and omissions, there are surety bond requirements and there are insurance requirements. Mm-hmm. The $100,000 or more might be debatable. Mm-hmm. That was a dollar recommendation from a private investigator here in the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a page from the city of Fairbanks, and the city of Fairbanks requires licensing for private investigators, and one of the things that they require, a surety bond of $10,000. If you are out of state, licensed in two or more states, it's $20,000. And so the surety bond part is pretty standard.
Okay.
The errors and omissions insurance, I'm not sure. I would have to check and just see if there's more other places, but I know that was at a request of a private investigator.
Okay. And then my third question, and just a quick comment, is about the concealed handgun requirement. You said that these individuals could put themselves, because of the nature of the work, at some risk. That's probably true. But are there Second Amendment issues there, in your opinion? And that's top of page 9.
Mm-hmm. No, because I didn't have
a chance. Particularly the concealed carry part,
mm-hmm.
since that's not a requirement of law.
Sure. So through the chair, Representative Josephson, we were asked that by just an individual calling in interested in the bill, mm-hmm. and so I did pose the questions to Legislative Legal Services and got their memo about 30 minutes before the meeting started.
And I haven't read it.
Right. So I did question about the right to conceal carry. And our constitutional right, it says Alaska law does not prohibit anyone 21 years age or older who may legally possess a firearm from carrying it concealed. So anyone could carry it concealed. A special permit is not required, nor is any specific training. Alaska also provides that a person may obtain a permit to carry a concealed handgun, and she uses firearm in one part of the memo and handgun in the second part of the memo. And the primary reason to obtain an Alaska concealed handgun permit is to be able to carry a concealed handgun in other states. So that's part of the concealed carry response. In order to get a concealed handgun permit, a person is required to successfully complete an approved handgun course under AS 1865-715, and that's typically conducted by the state troopers, and there are a couple of private entities that conduct that course. Mm-hmm. And then the committee last year spoke at length about this mm-hmm. and asked us to put it back in because there was a feeling that if there was an opportunity for them to carry a weapon into a situation that could be higher risk, that they have some sort of training and an understanding in the use of a weapon in that particular circumstance.
Okay.
And so that's why it's in.
And
yeah, I mean, the last thing, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that I flagged was the penalties for failure to comply with, for example, the investigator agency's certificate. I just don't know enough about whether those are consistent with other failures. So if I call myself a nurse and I'm not one, am I subject to a year in jail? That's what an A misdemeanor is. And some of these things could be sort of technical. So if I waited 31 days to talk about changes to my partners, that would be enough for, I suppose, a prosecutor who was bored to prosecute me. So that was just a concern I had. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Representative Ledoux.
Yes. I'm looking at all of the exemptions. It looked like there are quite a few of them. So I'm wondering if, why? Why are there exemptions for attorneys? Why are there exemptions for insurance company investigators? Why are there exemptions for a whole bunch of folks? If all of the horrendous things that you've talked about can happen if you set yourself up in business as a private investigator, as opposed to working for an individual attorney or working for an individual insurance company, why can't they all happen under those circumstances? Why are you only concerned with somebody who has their own individual business as opposed to all of these, what I think, 18 people or 18 categories?
Thank you for that question. It's an excellent observation. One of the differences is, and I understand your concern, is that this is someone that is solely doing the act of private investigating, wherein in many of the exemptions, if not all of them, it's just part of their duties, and they also have some other oversight. I realize that the same concerns whether someone is a felon. In fact, I didn't tell you that one. It was really quite not so good, is that the felon was found to have committed sex crimes, a felony in another state. So, yes, I suppose that you would be concerned about that person in the other field. It could be, and I don't know this, and perhaps the division director could speak to this, that some of those other professions require their own licensing, and they may cover some of these things in that already, and there is already some review of their ability and appropriateness to be in that role.
Okay. Follow up here. So, I mean, I'm looking at one person who is employed exclusively or regularly by one employer that is not a private investigator and who performs investigations solely in connection with the affairs of that employer. So that could very well be somebody who's working for an insurance company, and that's what their job is to do. Conduct investigations, you know, that's 24/7 or 40 hours a week. That's what they do. So, I mean, I'm kind of thinking that if we're going to do this, we should do it for everybody.
Do you have any other explanations?
Yes, so through the chair, Representative Ledoux. One of the concerns that came up and why some of these exemptions were established is when you go to the business licensing section and you choose North American Industry Classification System, the NAICS code, it's just a checkbox or a number that you identify on your application. The section that you sign up for is called Administrative and Support and Waste Management and Remediation Services. That's the big title. And then when you drill down, you can pick investigation and security services, investigation services. It's a very, very broad business title. And so we wanted to identify certain people who are, they're investigating circumstances or individuals for a very specific purpose. And a private, and typically for another employer, they're usually governed or they have other oversight, you know, that's going to be seeing what they're doing. A private investigator is typically the ones that, we were approached about trying to license are people who tend to be in business for themselves or create their own agency. They have, because their business code is so broad, they have a lot of latitude on what they can do, how they research, what they ask for, tend to get access to a little bit more confidential related databases, and they can pose themselves differently. If you are in the job of being an insurance adjuster, you're going to be carrying somebody's insurance card, you're going to be an employee of them. If you started to have an issue, you would go back to that insurance company and say, you know, he's checking out my flat tire, why did he ask me about my child, you know. So there's other ways to kind of remediate that. If you're a private investigator, you might be there to ask about the child. So all of these are job types that seem to have other oversight.
Just follow up. But that doesn't mean that if you're hired by the insurance company or by the either the plaintiffs or the defense bar, that as an employer or as an employee, that you can't kind of misidentify yourself, and yes, somebody might go back to the attorney or the insurance company and they might say, tough, we told them to get the information.
Mm-hmm. I'll just respond, and I do appreciate your concern. It's, you know, does everyone that's going to put on a Band-Aid, do we need to license them as an LPN? I mean, there has to be, I believe, a limit. Even I understand your concern, but again, these exemptions do have oversight, and they indeed may even, their requirements in their profession maybe actually have some of the very same things and a set of requirements they have to meet that might address the concerns that you have and ensure that they are appropriate in their role.
I understand that they might, but I'm not sure that they necessarily do. That's just my concern.
And we could perhaps get that information from the division. I don't know how many exemptions there are and how many of them have to go through a licensing process, but we could maybe get that information for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, I think we're going to go on to the fiscal note. Hopefully get through that before 5 o'clock. Come on up, Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Acting Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
Welcome back.
Thank you. The fiscal note that the department forwarded for this bill reflects the level of staffing. Primarily, it's the expenses due to not only starting up a brand new program, but also the level of staffing that we are anticipating as a result of the responsibilities to license and to also enforce licensure for this program. Ms. Blaisdell expressed, there's quite a threshold for licensure, and that not only would our licensing examiner be going through the process of gathering and doing a sort of a quantitative review of that, all the information that would be required to be supplied. But our investigators, our professional investigators, would need to also perform an investigation to review the veracity, the whether there was information that was presented that was make sure that they were presenting information that was true, and then also not withholding information that would keep them from meeting the threshold of licensure. So that is the increase in staffing that under my review of the fiscal note and my experience with the division am proposing. Because of the receipt-supported services and the way that our division staffing and funding operates, what we do not expect to happen is that 100% of either the examiner or the investigator's time to be charged back to the private investigator licensing program. We learned a lesson last year in legislation where we received three new licensing programs and a significant expansion of a licensing program, but failed to ask for any additional support within the division. One of those programs has a board, and so we, because we reached a critical mass with one little program, we could absorb it. With another little program, we could absorb it. A brand new board, three programs, and an expansion, we couldn't absorb it, and we had no provision in our fiscal notes to be able to go to prevent that tipping point with our staff. So we've requested the staff, the minimum amount of staff we believe we would need for this program, with the idea that during certain times of the year and perhaps a portion of the staff throughout the year would be charged to other licensing programs where we really could use another hand to be able to meet service requirements. So several dynamics going on with the fiscal note, staffing being the primary one.
Who's got the first question?
Well, Representative Joseph. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the other three new kids on the block from last year, would they start to question why? It sounds like you would shift some of this burden to them. And would they question that? And if I misheard you, it's only because it's been a long day. On the one hand, it wouldn't be fair for the private investigators to absorb their problem, the 2014 new members. But on the other hand, if they got a free ride that they shouldn't have gotten, can you now explain to them why their licensure fees would go up? Or am I missing this totally?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, I think that's an excellent question. We have the level of effort that we have regardless of the number of staff. It just depends really on whether we want to license people within 3 weeks, 6 weeks, or a year. The volume reflects not the activities we do, but the service level we can provide to stakeholders in the state. So there would not be necessarily an additional cost that we can point to a specific licensing program. We would like to be able to provide a high level of service to the state. So as an example, the medical board just went through their renewal period, and we also were hit with an influx of applications. Our new application review has taken a lot longer than we would like, because we didn't have enough hands on deck because they hit during a renewal cycle. Having additional staff would help us be able to pull in people in those seasonal shifts from existing programs and be able to ensure that, and that using that example, that hospitals were able to be fully staffed and not close down service units because we couldn't license a doctor in 3 months. So we aren't we're going to deliver that service level. Alaska has a high expectation for service, and those particular programs are not ones that we would necessarily point the finger as getting additional expenses. It could be any of our licensing programs along that cycle of renewal where extra hands are needed on deck.
Thank you. Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Ledoux.
Thank you for being here, and I'm sorry I didn't get to chat with you about this earlier. I was quite surprised when I saw this because, as I mentioned earlier, it's almost quadruple what the fiscal note was last year. And when you gave a review of your division, you said the range for licenses were about the minimum was $50 for some professions, up to $1,700 for midwives, I believe. And looking on the third page of the fiscal note, it is $2,900 for private investigators, and with about 140, 150 in the state, that gets it up actually higher than what I see for your fiscal note at $435,000. The fiscal note was $60,000 last year. And you said you made the error of three new professions being licensed last session, but didn't account for that. So it seems to me maybe this is somehow being added in here, and we're asking private investigators to help supplement and provide funding to your division to cover these other boards that were established last year. My purpose was not to create a bureaucracy. If there are 140 that we think in the state, and to have, I believe, 1.5 employees for that is not at all my intention. We patterned this after what we thought were some processes already in place for other professions. For the most part, there may have been one or two, but I thought pretty much everything, whether it was the fingerprinting, those kind of things are required for other professions. So I am very concerned about how high this is, and would hope that we could work on this and just question also adding to it to help provide for the other professions, if you could comment on that.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hughes, as I mentioned, we would not expect the full 1.5 positions to always be working on these programs. We, other than a fiscal note, we don't have the vehicle to request staff, and so by adding on a program, then we need to request the minimum amount of staff that we would expect. If an investigator, for example, when this program rolls out, and we may need a full-time investigator for a month, we may need 80% of an investigator for 3 months, we may need 60% of an investigator for 6 months, and then after the initial licensure period, an ongoing commitment for an investigator of 30-40%, depending on review of licensure, review of all the exemptions that are listed, any complaints that come in. So the fiscal note is the third page of the fiscal note, where we're looking at potential license fee, is absolutely, from what we can estimate, the worst case scenario and not the likely scenario for a licensing fee, because we don't actually know exactly how many private investigators will apply for licensure, how many complaints we'll get. Our fee setting process is very dynamic and depends a lot on factors outside of our control. It's likely that private investigators would actually pay a lower licensing fee, perhaps more along the line of midwives, because of the lower number of applications and the higher threshold for licensure than many of our programs. But the $2,900 is what we know today with the request for this staff. Any portion of that staff through our positive timekeeping process that would not be working on private investigators would be charged to the programs they're working on. So to use the example mentioned earlier in answer to Representative Josephson's question, if we have an examiner who we need to pull away from a program and ask to help the medical board, help barbers and hairdressers with their processing, that time would be charged to them and not to private investigators.
What is the ratio of staff that you have for other professions that don't have boards. So a profession that has 150 people in that profession, there's no board. How much staff do you have assigned? What's the ratio of staff to the number of licensees? 1.5 seems very high to me. And putting it on the backs of private investigators, it does not seem right.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hughes, it really depends on the program and the statutory requirements of the division to implement the program. We have programs that have under 100 licensees with one full-time staff. We have programs with a couple of thousand of licensees who have a very minimal licensure process, as well as a minimal investigative team that may have one staff member or half a staff member. And because investigations are so volatile, we cultivate expertise within our investigators, but their time may vary depending on whether they are dealing with an intense investigation, a high-risk investigation, an appeal, and so we may have multiple investigators on a particular case at one time, and then they pull back down, and when that case is over, go back to a fraction of their time working on that program. So we could have, there is no standard because there is no standard statute. The bill proposes with the investigation of licensees and the information that's required in the list of exemptions, there's quite a bit of hands-on that we expect would not only be generated from the statute but also generated from the public, either those seeking licensure, exemption from licensure, or complaints. Again, the putting it on the backs of the private investigators, this fiscal note is highly unlikely that this amount would actually result in license fees, because we do not anticipate 1.5 people full-time to be employed supporting this program. But we do need more people. We cannot absorb this program. And so, again, having learned a lesson last year, we need an opportunity to request staff, and then we, using positive timekeeping, will charge the appropriate licensing program that they're actually working on.
Representative Ledoux, you've got a minute and a half.
I'm fine.
Follow-up? Representative Hughes?
Well, I just have concerns, obviously, that, you know, that, and you've explained it. You don't need to explain it again, why it was quadrupled, and using this as a vehicle. I don't think the bill would pass with that fiscal note. In fact, I would pull it, because that was not my intention to add to the bureaucracy of the division. So thank you.
Well, I think it goes without saying that we'll be holding the bill over, and we will open it up to public testimony the next time it's up. And in the meantime, I hope we can get some sort of resolution on the pricing mechanism. And with that, we'll adjourn at 2 minutes after 5.